Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. At a time when the COVID-19 pandemic has put so many restrictions on our lives, it's a nice change to think about the outdoors and outdoors recreation. The Great American Outdoors Act, signed into law by President Trump last week with widespread bipartisan support, will provide $3 billion a year to conservation projects, outdoor recreation, and maintenance of national parks and other public lands. What will it mean for Pennsylvania? That's our discussion on the first portion of today's program. Our guest, Lauren Ingram, who is Deputy Secretary for Conservation and Technical Services with the Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. Ms. Ingram, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Great to be here, Scott.
Stephanie Wine, clean water and conservation advocate with the environmental group Penn Environment. Stephanie Wine, always good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
And Stephen Sims, superintendent of the Gettysburg National Military Park and Eisenhower National Historic Site. Mr. Sims, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalk@WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Before we get to the American Outdoors Act, some breaking news yesterday. President Trump said he will accept the Republican nomination for president at the White House or at Gettysburg. Mr. Sims, I have to ask you, have you been contacted about the president speaking from the battlefield?
At this time, we have yet to be contacted.
You have not heard anything from the White House?
Not directly, no.
So your reaction when you heard that he may says he may speak from Gettysburg?
Yeah, it's definitely something that we would take into consideration. We would talk to the White House and, or the representatives and process a permit application for something like that.
Now, you said you haven't heard directly. Have you heard indirectly or just through the media?
Oh, just through the media.
Just through the media. One of the questions that arises is it legal, because this would be a political thing, on federally owned land like the battlefield?
So what we would do is, once we receive that application, we would definitely run it through our solicitor's office to review everything that we receive. My understanding is that it could be done as a First Amendment activity.
As a First Amendment activity. So no one, you don't plan to reach out to the White House and say, this is what we have heard publicly. Is there anything to this?
No, we would not reach out directly.
So you will wait for the White House to contact you?
Yeah, and we do have folks in our regional and national offices that are in contact with the Secretary's office, Secretary of Interior as well. So I think there's a lot of people having conversation about it.
You mean about this particular issue?
Asking questions, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is that what normally happens when there's something like this?
I don't know if it... what normally happens is actually my first time experiencing this sort of thing.
Would you like the president to speak from Gettysburg?
No, I have no opinion on that.
No opinion. Okay. All right, so let's get back to the Great American Outdoors Act. Stephanie Wine, I want to start with you when we're talking about the conservation aspect of this. This law provides money for the Land and Water Conservation Fund. What is that, and what will this money go toward?
So the Land and Water Conservation Fund, we like to call it the most important conservation program most Americans have never heard of. And in its 54-year history, this fund has provided money for conservation programs across the entire country, from really iconic federal lands that people think of, like Allegheny National Forest and our battlefields here in Pennsylvania and places like the Grand Canyon out west, up down to little parks in every county and all across the Commonwealth, so municipal pools and ball fields and playgrounds. Since its inception, it's actually invested $325 million in parks and recreation here in the Commonwealth. But the problem is that every year Congress raids money allocated for conservation to other purposes. And so it's never been fully funded. The money set aside for conservation has never been fully given over to the parks and open spaces where it's intended for. And the Great American Outdoors Act puts sort of a lock and key on those resources so that all that money, all $900 million, is going towards conservation and open space protections across the country.
So basically what you're saying, and what the difference is with this Outdoors Act, is it is permanent funding that can't be touched by Congress.
Exactly. So over the 54-year history, $22 billion has been raided from the Land and Water Conservation Fund for other purposes. And while the program was made permanent last year with a bipartisan support effort that we were involved in, it wasn't until just this summer that we actually made the funding permanent so that we can't raid or touch those funds for other purposes. They're going to have to go to conservation where they belong.
Lauren, let me turn to you with DCNR, Lauren Ingram. What's the impact? I mean, Stephanie talked about some, but what is the impact overall of this in Pennsylvania?
So in Pennsylvania, with Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, we manage the stateside portion of the Land and Water Conservation Fund. So as Stephanie mentioned, it's funded many, many sites across the country. And here in Pennsylvania, we funded 1,200 individual sites over the 50-plus year history of the fund. So that means there's at least 1,200 sites in Pennsylvania that are permanently protected, permanently available for outdoor recreation. And we haven't gotten the allotment that we had expected back in the 60s, except for maybe two times in the early 70s. So we've always had a reduced amount of money from what was anticipated from the law. So the great thing about this permanent and full funding is that we can expect $10 to $12 million per year for Pennsylvania outdoor recreation amenities and parks, new parks. And this will supplement the state funding that we have through the Keystone Park Recreation and Conservation Fund and the Environmental Stewardship Fund, and will mean that we can do a lot more projects across the state. And this year for our grant program, we had a record high number of applications and demand. So we're really excited about that and this additional funding that will be coming in the years to come will help to fund a lot more projects, places that many of us know, like Fort Hunter. We've done projects there, Latorte Park in Carlisle. Many state parks, most state parks have land and water conservation funding in them, and as you know, both our local and state parks have a need for modernization and upgrades, and this money is going to help to advance that work moving forward.
You know, what you're saying may surprise some people, because when they think of a state park or a county park, they think that everything that is paid for in that park comes from the state. And what you're saying is that here's some federal money that will go toward maintenance and creating new parks. And, I mean, as Stephanie even mentioned, down to ball fields, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. For example, there's 100 swimming pools across the state that have received LWCF funding, and they're a good lot of need for swimming pool improvement. So we'll be looking and expecting more applications to fund things like swimming pools, ball fields, trails, playgrounds, all the amenities that you expect in a state and local park can be funded through the Land and Water Conservation Fund. And as we know, in this time of COVID, people are really visiting our state parks and our local parks and trails and really finding respite in those areas. And so this additional funding from the Land and Water Conservation Fund, this additional federal funding, will help to make even more improvements to those areas that we all enjoy here in Pennsylvania.
Stephen Sims, let's talk about the Gettysburg National Military Park and Eisenhower National Historic Site. How will some of this money be used in Gettysburg and at Eisenhower?
Yeah, so the legislation provides up to $1.9 billion a year for 5 years for repair of critical facilities and infrastructure in national parks, forests, wildlife refuge, and recreation areas. And so we named it the National Parks and Public Lands Legacy Restoration Fund. And with nearly $12 billion in maintenance backlog nationally, it's direly needed. And it's going to be a great thing for our parks and for our visitors to our parks. For Gettysburg and Eisenhower, combined, we have about $65 million in maintenance backlog in both these parks. So this Great American Outdoors Act could help with some of that maintenance backlog in improving facilities, improving our historic farmhouses and barns, replacing outdated water systems and other critical infrastructure, repairing our roads. All of those are possibilities with the Great American Outdoors Act.
You know, $55 million is nothing to sneeze at, but at the same time, when you talk about more than $1 billion going to national parks and lands across the country, I noticed that you said some of our maintenance needs. I'm thinking that you're not anticipating that whole $55 million in maintenance backlog would be taken care of like in year one.
Well, I think it's a five-year program, and it's going to take a lot of time to put these projects together, and we don't know exactly which projects are going to be approved yet. And so, in 90 days, I believe the administration is going to submit that list to Congress for review and approval. And as those projects get funded and executed, it will resolve some of that maintenance backlog and improve our operational posture within each of these parks. So this is going to be a really positive thing for the National Park Service.
You mentioned some of the maintenance that would be needed at Gettysburg. Is there a priority? Is there something that if the federal government wrote you a check today specifically for maintenance, that you would say, here's what has to be done, here's how that money would be spent?
Yeah, so our mission is to preserve and conserve the resources here at the battlefield, as well as Eisenhower home at National Historic Site. And so we would push as much of that funding to those maintenance backlog needs to preserve that historic fabric, preserve that historic scenery, the natural and cultural scenery, as well as provide increased access for our visitors to increase visitor enjoyment. So there's a lot of opportunity to do that, to improve our resources and provide that to the public.
I'm curious, does part of preserving those resources mean making the battlefield look as much as it can like 1863?
That is the goal, yes, absolutely. So we want to maintain that historic scenery so that when the visitor comes to the battlefield, they can immerse themselves in what it might have been like on July 1, 2, or 3 of 1863 and be able to visualize what's happening and understand the context of the Civil War. So that is the goal, which is why back in 1999, the park had a general management plan which did exactly that. We restored the battlefield to that 1863 appearance so that visitors can experience that.
And by the way, excuse that sneeze. When I'm working from home, I guess I didn't hit the microphone to turn it off. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF. You're home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we have one topic that is related to the environment. Unnamed streams. Do you realize that 95% of the streams in Pennsylvania, well, not just in Pennsylvania, across the country, 95% of streams in Pennsylvania, here I am again, across the country do not have names. And why that's significant is that those that do have names tend to be taken care of a little bit better. Stephanie Wine, did you know that?
Yeah, I had heard that. And it makes sense. When you name something, it, you know, creates a sense of place and it creates a sense of value. So it definitely makes sense to me.
Well, that's one of the topics we'll be discussing on tomorrow's program. During this portion of today's show, we are talking about the Great American Outdoors Act, which was signed into law by President Trump last week, providing billions of dollars, permanent dollars, for the outdoors, outdoors recreation, National Park Service, public lands, federal lands across the country. Our guest today, Lauren Ingram, who is Deputy Secretary for Conservation and Technical Services with the Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, Stephanie Wine, Clean Water and Conservation Advocate with Penn Environment, and Stephen Sims, Superintendent of the Gettysburg National Military Park and Eisenhower National Historic Site. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, so let me bring up some of the criticisms of this. And, you know, as I said in the introduction, there was bipartisan support for this. The president signed it, but there were both Democrats and Republicans on board. Very few legislators, members of Congress, who opposed this. And if they did, they probably had a reason. But one of the reasons that you do hear is that that this is not enough money for the number of maintenance projects across the country. Lauren Ingram, let me start with you. Let's go with that.
Well, I think you can always say that there's not enough money for almost anything that we need to do as a country or as a state, but I like to focus on, you know, what we can do, and this will be a significant improvement in addition to the funding that we put here in our state and local parks. And what we'll need to do is we'll need to prioritize that funding, and we do that in Pennsylvania and indeed in every state that gets land and water, which is all the states. We're required to do a statewide comprehensive outdoor recreation plan every 5 years. And Pennsylvania just finished ours up. It's available on our website now. And it's called Recreation for All, and it has a strong focus on equity of access to parks and equity to good parks, parks that are safe and clean and ready for folks to use. We did an analysis with the Trust for Public Land on park access, and we have a goal for folks to have a park within a 10-minute walk in areas where you could walk to a park, or a 15-minute drive from their home, so that we can focus on the equitable access that people can get to these respites, these areas for outdoor recreation, these areas that have, you know, improvement to our health and wellness, which is so important now. So as you say, you know, maybe it's not enough money, probably isn't, but it gets us a good way forward in making improvements and improving the quality of life for Pennsylvanians.
You touched on something that I wanted to ask about anyway, Lauren. Why is this important now? I mean, we're in the middle of a pandemic. There are states that Pennsylvania, for example, looking at a $5 billion deficit. So there will be a lot of need for every cent there is. Why is it important now?
Well, I think, I mean, you're right. There are huge needs in the country, and access to outdoor spaces is just one of those needs. But I think particularly now we're really seeing the benefit of parks and outdoor spaces and trails for our health and wellness, both because we are staying home more and going to local places to visit and get outside, get kids outside, get families outside, really spend the time that we have now that we can't maybe visit some of the spaces that we might normally have visited in the, you know, when we weren't in a pandemic, to really enjoy these areas. And I think because of the record visitation that we're seeing at our state parks and local parks and trails, people are realizing that the outdoor spaces close to home are a good place to spend time right now. And because of that, we should direct resources and funding to them, because it is something that can be a real benefit to our population, really across the board, from, you know, little kids to older folks that want to just take a walk in the park, or folks who want to take a picnic with their family because they can't get together with a larger group. So all these things show the need for parks. And we know that parks are also a great space for equity. All kinds of people go to parks. All people go to parks. And we're seeing a lot of issues around equity in our country right now, and having free, accessible recreation to all the people of Pennsylvania is, I think, really important investment of tax dollars and tax and other resources from the state and federal government.
Mr. Sims, I'm curious as to what visitation has been like during the pandemic to Gettysburg, the National Military Park, and the Eisenhower National Historic Site.
Yeah, I don't have any official visitation numbers that I can share with you, but I can say that, you know, for the state of Pennsylvania, for the 18 national park units that are in the state, annually it's about 10 million visitors every year. And that translates into about $711 million in economic impact to the gateway communities of these parks. And so when we have the Great American Outdoors Act investing $1.9 billion a year for critical maintenance needs in these parks, it really brings the condition, because, you know, parks are loved to death. And it really brings the condition of these parks into much better condition, so more people want to come visit. And when more people come visit, you know, they, again, contribute to that gateway economy. So I think it's really critical. You mentioned timing of this act, and I think it's critically important that we do these investments, have these investments in our parks, so people want to continue to come and continue to love the outdoors and learn something and immerse themselves in a very special place that they can connect to.
Stephanie, from an environmental standpoint, why is this important? Stephanie Wine, are you there?
Yes, I am. Sorry about that.
There you are. Okay. See, this is a little weird for all of us when we're on the phone and at home and all that, you know?
I know. Thanks for your patience with technology. Yeah, it's important to the environment for the obvious reason that when we have more resources to conserve more land, we are going to protect more biodiversity. We're going to protect more of critical watersheds. And we're going to preserve more of our critical, from everything from our wetlands to our forests. But then also we know the less obvious reason, I think, is that the studies show that when people experience nature, they're more likely to protect it. And so when folks, especially as kids, are getting out to parks and experiencing nature, when people can take that respite, as Lauren says, they're more likely to support policies and call on our leaders to make conservation a priority. People will only protect what they know and understand is valuable. And so for us, it's really exciting that the full set of resources will be available to continue to not only refurbish and restore, but actually expand the public lands protected in the state.
Some of this money is coming from fees on fossil fuel energy producers. And there are those who say that doesn't make sense at a time when climate change is a major issue and you're trying to get away from fossil fuels, that there are those that, like the National Park Service, the money being used for some of these projects, some of these parks, some of these conservation funds coming from the fossil fuel industry. Stephanie, I'll ask you, does it make sense to do that?
It's a really good question. I mean, while, you know, this program was set up, you know, over 50 years ago when climate change wasn't on anybody's radar, and while that money is still coming in, it makes sense to be spent as it was intended on conservation projects. Penn Environment, we work a lot on climate change. It's a major priority for us. We support the bill for 100% renewable energy in the Pennsylvania State House. And so obviously we want to see a transition away from dirty fossil fuels in the future altogether. And when that transition happens, hopefully sooner rather than later, we will need to talk about alternative funding streams for the Land and Water Conservation Fund. But while that revenue is still coming in, it absolutely needs to be spent as intended, which is protecting our public lands. Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things I did want to ask about, and Lauren Ingram, you have touched on this, and this is in concert with the pandemic, is that there have been reports this week of overcrowding in Pennsylvania state parks, that, you know, a lot of people not maintaining social distance, or those maybe not wearing masks. Tell us about that. And, you know, apparently there are some parks that are overcrowded and others that aren't.
Yeah, so we put out a notice on our website noting that there are some places where we are experiencing overcrowding. And we're encouraging folks to take a look at some alternative sites. So we have 121 state parks in Pennsylvania, 2.2 million acres of state forest, 6,100 local parks, and 12,000 miles of trails. So if you get to a park and it's too crowded, get out your smartphone and look at our website and search for some other places that are nearby that maybe aren't as crowded. And that'll help to spread people out more, give you a better experience when you visit these parks, and give you a new spot to look at, a new spot to enjoy. So we encourage folks to look at the resources on our website to find other areas if you are planning a visit to a park, or if you get to one that's too crowded, maybe have a couple other ones in mind to go to when you get there. If you get to the trailhead and it's full, find another trailhead. So we're asking folks to do that. Again, this is indicative of how much people want to get outside and enjoy the natural world right now. So again, be smart, think about other places to go, and wear your mask when you're visiting our facilities, and then you can have an enjoyable time visiting our great park system here in Pennsylvania.
What are some of the parks that are experiencing overcrowded conditions today?
Yeah, I think if you look at the web notice, one of the ones in the local area is Cador State Park, and that I think is probably because there's swimming areas there. And, you know, there's other places folks could go in the local area, but there's a whole list on the list on our website of some of the other places. Ohio Pile out in western Pennsylvania, Ricketts Glen in the central part of the state. Many of these are places that, of exceptional beauty or exceptional recreation. But, again, there's lots of other places that have those exceptional activities as well. So take a look at alternatives when you're thinking about where you want to go.
Yeah, Ricketts Glen, with the trails that go along the waterfalls, not a whole lot of room to social distance, and it always is one of the most popular. My family was just at Bald Eagle in Center County last week, and I, right off the bat, this was a Wednesday, but I said to my wife, wait, you know, there's people really spread apart on this beach that, you know, social distancing was not a problem. So I'm sure that you just have to kind of figure out where you can go where there aren't as many people.
Absolutely. Like I said, there's lots of opportunities for outdoor recreation. So take a look at some other sites to experience some new areas.
I want to thank our guest for being with us today. Lauren Ingram is Deputy Secretary for Conservation Technical Services with the Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, Stephanie Wine, Clean Water and Conservation Advocate with Penn Environment, and Stephen Sims, Superintendent of the Gettysburg National Military Park and Eisenhower National Historic Site. Thank you all for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on Thursday's Smart Talk, I want to mention to you, mention this to you because we've been doing it every few weeks during the pandemic. We have an infectious disease specialist appearing on the program to answer questions about COVID-19, the coronavirus. We've been doing this since the beginning, March. And, it never fails to surprise me of how many new questions come up even 5 months into this about COVID-19, but that's coming up on Thursday's program. The Black Lives Matter movement and focus on inequality and discrimination of the last 3 months has led to statues and monuments to Confederate Civil War leaders and those who may have been racist in their lifetimes being torn down or replaced. Questioning or criticizing history wasn't just confined to African Americans. Native Americans, many of whom have long been critical of sports mascots that portray them, have become more vocal. Today's Smart Talk includes a conversation with several people who want the Susquehanna Township High School Indians to change their name and mascot. Joining us is Alin Rosenberger, 2013 Susquehanna Township High School graduate and a Stanford Law School graduate who launched a community campaign to retire the school's mascot. Ms. Rosenberger, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having us on, Scott.
Also, James Cruz is a 1989 alumni of Susquehanna High School. He also is of Native American heritage. Mr. Cruz, welcome to the show.
All right, thank you very much for having me.
1-800-729-7532 is our phone number if you have a question or a comment, and we definitely want to hear from you on this topic because we know there are a lot of people out there who have opinions on this topic. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Alin Rosenberger, what prompted you to work to change this name?
Yeah, so we started a petition about a month ago now, and I was inspired by this really profound reckoning our country is having with both its history of pernicious racism and with the structural racism that pervades society today. And oftentimes, I think the most effective way for us to combat systemic racism in our own communities is by thinking about what symbols we want to uphold and which we need to abolish to promote the values of a diverse and inclusive community. Our country is still mourning the loss of Congressman John Lewis, and he often said, you have to stand up, speak up, and speak out against injustice. And I, too, am a very firm believer that a loud voice can be your most powerful tool, and that when you see injustice, you have an obligation to speak out against it. And Susquehanna's racist mascot is undeniably an injustice.
I mentioned that you graduated from Stanford Law School. Stanford mm-hmm. also was known as the Indians until changing its name to the Cardinal probably 10 years ago or so. Did that influence you at all, or is that just a coincidence?
It did. I was really inspired by Stanford's change, I think, because it demonstrates the feasibility of doing something like this. I mean, a large university like Stanford was able to make this change. And I also, in writing the petition and thinking about how I wanted to promote this issue, I referenced back to a lot of the conversations that Stanford had and that Stanford students engaged in when they were going through this change and the points that they made, and that was really helpful for me in grappling with this issue.
What specifically is offensive about the Indian name and the mascot?
Yeah, so there's quite a few things. I mean, decades of social science research demonstrate the negative psychosocial effects these mascots have on both Native and non-Native children. These mascots perpetuate a very simplified stereotype that completely discounts the contributions, perspectives, and struggles of contemporary Native people. We know that Native American youth are vulnerable to the dehumanizing effects of these mascots. And among other students, these mascots just normalize culturally insensitive behavior, which is particularly problematic at a diverse school like Susquehanna. The majority of Susquehanna students are Black or Latinx, and having a group of people as a mascot tells those students the majority can put down and demean any group of people. I mean, even a simple sports headline like Bishop McDevitt beats Susquehanna Indians is harmful, it's violent, and it's offensive.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Cruz, you are a Susquehanna graduate, and as I mentioned, you are of Native American heritage. So you graduated in 1989. During the time you were at Susquehanna, were you offended by the mascot and the name of Indians?
Yes, because, again, I was taught the actual history as opposed to, you know, what you read in the textbooks by my parents. So knowing that history, I knew the how harmful it would be to those, particularly on reservations, because sometimes that's the only characterizations that they see outside of the reservations are what they see on television and what they see in the local schools and everything else. And it's the same thing with being off reservation. You know, what you see, like, on cartoons when I was growing up and at the rallies and events, you know, was just not an accurate representation of us as Native peoples.
What would be an accurate representation?
Well, I mean, now it's we're a very diverse community, just like every other community. I mean, we don't all look alike. So, you know, just seeing a large headdress and face paint and large nose, you know, that's not an accurate representation of us. We don't all look like the back of a buffalo nickel. The Navajo Nation does not look anything like the Sioux Nation, who does not look like anything like the Eastern Woodland Indians. So as it stands, I don't believe anyone should be represented. No people should be represented as a mascot, because you're not going to get it, you know, accurate. You know, it's just, most of the time, it's just going to be a characterization, or it's going to speak to a time when they were, oh, the savage honorable Indians, or, you know, speaking to a time past when it was just romanticized because of the fight. And that's not the way, you know, we want to be represented. We work in our communities, we're business owners, we're contributing to society, so we would like to be equally represented.
You mentioned the back of a buffalo nickel. Is that offensive, or is that an honor? How do you look at that?
I think that, you know, you can look at it both ways. I mean, and communities could be divided on that. But at the same time, you know, it's just the idea that we're all have one specific look. You know what I mean? Which would harken back to, like, the cowboy and Indian movies or Dances with Wolves. You know, a lot of the things that you saw on television were more of the Plains Indian Wars, which doesn't speak to, you know, the struggles of the Eastern Woodland and Algonquin Indians, which were the first line of defense when it came to the colonizers. So, you know, you're grouping them all into one look. And so when you talk to individuals, they might say, well, I never met a Native American before. You might have. I'm not going to stroll down the street, you know, on a painted horse with a headdress on, you know what I mean? But, you know, I'm not going to announce myself, hi, I'm James, I'm a Native American. You know what I mean? It's just that you may have interacted with us, but your idea and perception of what we're supposed to look like may not line up with what you see.
You know, it's kind of ironic that you mentioned that, because there are many people, especially since the hobby of genealogy has taken off, there are many people who like to claim that they have Native American heritage. Why is that?
I think a lot of it could be true because, through assimilation, you know, the government's, you know, policies were to assimilate and eradicate Native American culture. And the worst offender of that was 30 minutes down the street in Carlisle with the Carlisle Indian School. So they were trying to kill the Indian but save the man. So trying to integrate them more into us more into society, you know, there is a vast mix. This is a melting pot. So at the same time, too, you know, there's oftentimes, you know, people want to reach into other cultures and to study them and things like that. So I think, you know, there's some good and there's some bad with it. It's just, you know, you just don't know how far or how accurate the genealogical records are. But, you know, I mean, I get it, you know what I mean? Because, you know, a lot of people can do that now. They can just go into the DNA reports and be like, oh, you know, I'm 1%, you know, Native American. Well, that's fine. If it will help you to do your research and to educate yourself on Native American issues and the real story, then that's fine.
Let's take a phone call from Bill in Lancaster. Bill, you're on the air.
Good morning, Scott.
Hi, Bill.
I will say that I must disagree with some of what was said. Now, I do agree that we did treat the Native Americans very badly. However, what we see in the names of the different sports teams is actually a reverence for them. Have you ever heard of the Susquehanna Losers, the Susquehanna Jackasses, the Mannheim Idiots? No, we choose our names as a reverence to their abilities. In this case, as their reverence to being tough and combative in some ways, but very strong competitors. And that is not a slur. Now, I agree it is a generality. And the generality is done because you don't single out one particular area. I also agree that the Carlisle School was not a good thing, but the lady here and her other people are in the same vein as the people that touted the Carlisle School as saving the Native Americans, or in this case, the man, but not the image of the tribe. And the last thing is, there are a number of teams around called the Trojans and things like that. Has anybody realized how bad the Trojans were, particularly with their younger men, and sexually abusing them and being tough and hard and beating them to make them warriors? But I don't hear anybody complaining about that.
Hey, Bill, thank you very much for your call. Ms. Rosenberger, he brings up a lot of points, but the big one there, and we've gotten several emails from listeners saying this, and we've heard this before, that's really what this is it honoring Native Americans because they want their sports teams to be courageous, not afraid to fight. Assume that means competitive. How do you answer that?
Right. So, and I've heard this from a lot of folks as well over the past months that this mascot, quote unquote, honors Native Americans. And so by removing it, we're somehow erasing their history. But this sentiment is quite frankly a patronizing one. As James alluded to, Native Americans aren't an historical relic. They very much live among us today. And we know how they feel about these mascots, and it isn't honored. More than 145 tribal and civil rights organizations in the United States have called for the elimination of Native American mascots. Groups are moving to outlaw these mascots in Massachusetts and here in Pennsylvania. It's not a form of honoring. You know, we know that folks find these mascots offensive, and if it's offensive to just one person, then it's wrong, and it shouldn't be our mascot.
And again, to feed off of that, that's the gentleman's question or response was, it's very typical. It's individuals who are Native American trying to tell a Native American as to what's acceptable and what's not. And I just don't think that that's the right way to approach things. I think we need to have more education and more dialogue like we're having right now so that they can genuinely see how harmful these particular stereotypes and mascots are. You know, in particular, I mean, like, you wouldn't take the Cleveland Indians logo, which Native Americans are not Indians. That was a mistake Columbus made. But you wouldn't switch that with an actual East Indian characterization of Gandhi, because that would be a huge issue. But it's just that it's the 1%. It's the Native Americans that are socially and economically downtrodden. Our voices may not be as loud. And so a lot of individuals feel that they can just speak for us. And that's just not the way things should be.
Mr. Cruz, you identify yourself as a Native American rather than an American Indian?
Yes. I'll start with Native American, yes.
Mm-hmm. Reason I ask that question is because in the last 20 years or so, you know, people of your heritage have been referred to as Native Americans, but just in the last few years, there have been those historians even who have said American Indians because that's how they've been identified, and that actually Native Americans aren't really native to America if you go back 1,000 years or so where they immigrated from. Do you think American Indian is offensive?
I don't consider it offensive, but at the same time, too, I just don't agree with the Bering Strait theory. I mean, that me myself. I mean, I can't speak for everyone on that, but as far as you know, Native Americans not being the first people here, I have to disagree with that.
Okay.
We were definitely here when the colonizers arrived. So
here is an email from Thomas. It says that this conversation is typical of a liberal radio station. Why don't you have two sides on debating the issue? In my view, in some mascot names, I think it's a compliment to the group, such as the Fighting Irish of Notre Dame. Thomas, first of all, let me just say that this is an interview, and we don't debate every single issue. And because the phone lines are open, emails are open, as we just heard, we welcome those who may disagree and want to make their opinions known. So, but as far as the point that he makes, this kind of is similar to the point that Bill made, Ms. Rosenberger, and he uses the example of Fighting Irish. Isn't that a stereotype?
So I think that it's important to differentiate between who is using this name. I mean, Notre Dame is an Irish Catholic university, and so, you know, it's similar to the Sequoia High School in Oklahoma, which is a Native American school. 100% of its students are Native American, and they can and should have an Indian mascot. But we've spoken with students from this school who say they look at schools like ours and just don't understand why we have appropriated their culture and use an Indian as a mascot. They feel like we're taking their mascot, not honoring them. And so I think it's a very different context when you're looking at the school at which these mascots are used.
Let's take a phone call from Sharon in Mechanicsburg. Sharon, you're on the air.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I'm kind of at the end of my rope with all of this because we all matter. I think where things went crooked was when people started being politically correct. And I think now it's way blown out of proportion.
Mm-hmm.
We all have history. And history can't be changed. So let's stop knocking down statues and protesting and everybody stay in their lane. We all have the same opportunities. Let's look forward and be a happy American country again.
Thank you very much.
And if that's not going to happen, I'm next with Fat Lives Matter.
Thank you very much for your call. Let me just put that out there, Mr. Cruz. I can tell you're dying to respond, but political correctness run amok?
I don't think so, because this has been an ongoing issue. I mean, there have been individuals, you know, from the Native American community that have been protesting outside of Washington Stadium since the name has been instituted.
The
R word was identified as a racial slur over 100 years ago by Webster's Dictionary. I think that, you know, no, we can't change history, but we can learn from it. I just feel that, you know, in this particular case, you know, she speaks of a happy America again, and I just want to know what is she referring to, what point in time, because the further back you go, the more issues with civil rights you have. And I think that that's a particular issue here, is that when it comes to issues of civil rights, it constantly has to be a fight. There isn't just human rights given out. You know, the African-American community had to fight for their rights. Mm-hmm. Women had to fight for the right to vote. Native Americans have to fight. So I don't know what happy times she's referring to, But I just feel like, again, through education and through discussions, that we can hash these things out, and we'll be able to talk and work them out.
James Cruz, a 1989 alumni of Susquehanna High School who is Native American. Lynn Rosenberger, a 2013 Susquehanna Township High School graduate who started this movement. Ms. Rosenberg, we only have about 10 seconds left. What happens next?
Yeah, so the school board has promised us that they will release a statement on their plans by mid-September. So we are just trying to maintain movement around this issue and wait to see what they give us in September.
Thank you very much for being with us today. Talk to you tomorrow morning.